DK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Richard Cantu. Thanksgiving nearing its end for another year, and in the population centers of the Northeast U.S., the coldest air of the season so far is moving in.
The worst of the rain has left the I-95 corridor, but the winds behind it really adding to that bite in the air. We're still seeing snow fall for parts of New England, including Vermont, New Hampshire, upstate New York, and Maine. In the next 24 hours, more snow is anticipated, mainly for Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, and the cities surrounding it.
ABC News meteorologist Samara Theodore. Egg recall. Handsome Brook Farms recalling almost 11,000 24-count cartons of its Kirkland Signature organic-raised eggs. Suspected salmonella contamination. The reason? The recalled eggs sent to 25 Costco stores in the southeast U.S. For now, the Israel-Hezbollah ceasefire in Lebanon is, for the most part, holding, although the Israelis say they fired on suspected terrorists who breached conditions of the ceasefire. This is ABC.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
The Packers tonight in prime time. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It's the Green Bay Packers and Miami Dolphins at Lambeau Field. The Dolphins are tough against the run, led by linebackers coach Joe Barry, the former defensive coordinator for the Packers, and Anthony Weaver, who played for the Ravens and now runs Miami's defense, Matt LaFleur.
Their defense is outstanding. I think they do a great job in multiple areas, whether it's defending the pass. It's really tough to get explosive plays on them. So I think Anthony Weaver and his staff, Joe B, obviously has been a big help, I'm sure, to him, and good scheme. So it's going to be quite the challenge.
NBA, the Bucks are back home Saturday night against the Wizards. Milwaukee now 9-9 after that horrible 1-6 start.
We all know that collectively we have to step up as a unit. Individually, you got to step up, and it's just time to be ready. So we know what the job is. It's still the same assignment. We're all pros here. We know what to do.
That's Bucks center Brooke Lopez with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Harvey Kay, professor emeritus of democracy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Harvey, I know you're the big FDR expert.
1934, he decided that the inequality and the wealth accumulated at the top was a threat not only to the American economy, but also to the American democratic spirit, American democratic life.
Sounds like history's repeating itself.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. It is National Apprenticeship Week. Runs November 17th through the 23rd. This is the 10th annual National Apprenticeship Week. A time where we look at organizations, industry, labor groups who come together and say, hey, how do we train workers to do the work that needs to be done? How do we get people the skills, the opportunities, the things that they need to do to make lives better? And understand, you know, I've been talking about apprenticeship programs for years because I think the model is fantastic and should and could be used in every industry in this country. You know, we used to do a lot of this in the old days. You know, my grandparents' generation, you could start working in the mailroom and work your way up to be CEO. There are stories that I have heard. There are stories of people learning skills from an employer, starting off as, you know, as at the lowest level, and then learning and them nurturing that education. I know it's hard to believe in this day and age, hard to believe that there could be a partnership, but there is. And the unions, the building trade unions, they foster this better than anyone. The apprenticeship programs that they have, second to none. So when you see, you know, we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of these, the annual anniversary of these apprenticeship programs, it makes me think that it's a good opportunity to highlight why they're so important, especially now when there's all this talk around college debt. There's all this talk about rising costs of education. There's all this talk about, you know, should everyone go to college? And like with my own children, I said, look, if you want to go to college, we'll send you. But, you know, you got to know what you want to do on the other end. How much is the borrowing you may have to take going to be worth whatever it is you're going to do? And look, I'm not against, you know, paying for a good portion of it. But you have to know what you want to do in these days, because education costs are just out of control. And, you know, because I read something recently that, you know, the average college graduate, you know, graduates with somewhere between $35,000 and $40,000 in debt. That's a pretty sizable number. And, you know, for all those people of my generation who go, well, you know, I had to pay for my college. No, not anywhere near what we've done to the kids today. Massive redistribution of wealth. And you have to ask, you know, do you really want to go to college? Or do you want to work with your hands? For a generation now, at least. Started with my generation. We were told, yeah, you don't want to do those dirty jobs. Wear the white tie and the white shirt and the tie. Get the corner office. Service sector, that's where the future is. And now we're coming back around after we've destroyed the idea of working with our hands to the idea that we need people who can fix stuff. We need people who can lay pipe, and we need people who can lay brick, and we need people who can, you know, build skyscrapers. We need people who can do stuff. And no one does that better than our friends in the building trades, because their apprenticeship programs, as I said, fabulous. I myself, as a young man, wanted to get into one. They're extremely competitive, and were much more, even much more so back then, because they were a little more tightly held. Today, with things expanding the way they are, there is a great opportunity for high school kids, for even people, you know, in their 30s and 40s, looking for a second career, to get into these programs and get a great life. And our friends over at NABTU, the North American Building Trades Union, they put out this great little, you know, little information docket, if you will, you know, talking about some of the great things of apprenticeship programs. For instance, you know, you get paid while you're learning. You're on the job, you're doing your training, you're doing your classwork, you get paid. You get a paycheck, you get, you know, benefits. And that continues, training and classes and all that. You know, they earn a regular wage. The careers, the paycheck, the benefits, they grow and accumulate college credits to get an associate's degree at some point. And when they're done, they have zero debt. And the number that they threw out is when you're done with their time as an apprentice, they've gotten like $280,000 in wages and benefits, as opposed to the $35,000 to $40,000 in debt. And the difference being, once you graduate from the apprenticeship program, you're working, making really good money with no debt. Whereas you come out of college, you have no idea what you're going to get. I have a lot of friends who have college degrees. I myself have degrees that I'm not using. Now, look, I argue, you know, an education is good in creating well-rounded people, critical thinkers, all that stuff. I'm not putting down college at all. I think it's, you know, rich people are still sending their kids. So this idea of no one should go to is ridiculous. But if you've got kids who want to work with their hands, you got people who want to build things. And my building trades friends, you can't go for a car ride with them in any city that they live in without them telling you the tales of how they built that city. There's pride in it. And for me, these apprenticeship programs are important, which is why I say, you know, we should be using this model in you know, many other industries. Healthcare, for instance, I've often said, you know, we could start some kind of an apprenticeship program like this. You know, and as I understand, and I'm not going to speak with broad brushes, there are, you know, places where this is happening. Healthcare, cybersecurity, you know, education, you know, many of the high industry, high demand industries, they're trying. And if you go back to the Obama years, one of the pieces of legislation that came out of the Obama term was something called WIOA, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. It was something that I thought had great promise. And the idea was to give states money to be able to merge, you know, apprenticeship programs, community colleges, you know, all these different avenues for people to get the skills that they need with employers that they would bring in. And then they would try and marry this up to kind of create what the building trades apprenticeship programs have been doing for decades. And it's had some successes other than the Trump years when they tried to crush it. But this idea for me is still really important. You streamline services to get people the ability to get the employment and the training programs, the stuff that they need, and have it in a one-stop shop kind of thing. You get employers engaged because they need good employees. They need, you know, well-trained, competent, productive employees if they're going to make profit. Seems like a win-win to me. So this idea of partnering with employers to go, hey, you know, what do you need? With workers who need jobs, and then on the end of it, making those really good, high-paying jobs with great benefits. I don't use win-win very often, but this is kind of one of those win-win situations. Now, look, I'm a union guy, and the interests of the employers and the workers there are differences, but there still are some. You know, getting the employees and the training that to match up makes a lot of sense. And no one does this better than the union apprenticeship programs, which is why I'm glad that they have these apprenticeship weeks every year to talk about why these are so available, accessible, and important, and why we need as a country to have well-trained people building our skyscrapers, putting roofs on our kids, buildings and all school buildings and all of that. So when we come back, I'm going to talk to one of our friends from LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, to share some thoughts on their apprenticeship program. Maybe get some stories on, because look, we've talked to people who life-changing opportunities come out of this. You know, I remember a guy last year who got out of prison and, you know, had no real direction, fell into one of these apprenticeship programs, and, you know, now is leading the life that he always dreamed of. You know, the big house, the wife, the children, the opportunity, the future. And that to me, that's what's important. So when we come back, we're going to talk to our good friend from LIUNA. But I want to hear your thoughts. Any ideas? Got any friends, kids, anybody who in an apprenticeship program? I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, big week this week for working people. One of my favorite weeks of the year talking about apprenticeship programs. This is National Apprenticeship Week. It runs this week in November. And I look at the lives that these programs change. I look at the jobs that are created, the skills that are given to workers, and the fact, this is the important part, that the people who go through them aren't saddled with a lifetime of debt. So, you know, National Apprenticeship Weeks, I think the first one was 2015, and over that period of time, you've had some 1.4 million people participate in 10,000 National Apprenticeship Week events. This year, no different. That's why I've asked John LaConch to come talk with us. John is the executive director of LIUNA's Training and Education Fund, LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, of course. My pleasure.
So this is kind of a big deal, kind of all on display, the amazing work that unions in the building trades do to bring members in, train them, get them the skills to build the stuff that we kind of take for granted. Walk me through what you're doing.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, when you look at the size and scope of what we do, especially as the building trades as a whole, Rick, it's labor management working together to fund that. So it's no taxpayers. Money involved. Is there a grant here and there? Sure. But Lyuna alone invests over $200 million a year. And that's because of the relationship between the contractor and Lyuna. So we have about 70 training schools throughout the U.S. and Canada. Lyuna Training oversees those 70 training centers. And they are really the front line to the workers who are going through the apprenticeship program.
No, it's one of those models that I really like. And I think I wish we could do across industry after industry. And in fact, you know, when Obama was president, he came out with the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, where I had hoped that a lot of states would take the money and the resources to build programs like this. To give people in healthcare and in manufacturing and warehousing would give them the kind of opportunities that you guys give our building trades folks. It didn't really catch on as much as I wanted to, but it's a great model in my view.
Yeah, and again, I think it goes back to that partnership we have with our employers. Everybody looks at it and they say, well, it's the trade unions. But it really is the partnership that helps fund that because our contractors, whether it's our pre-apprenticeship program, our apprenticeship programs, they're as involved on even the frontline levels as the union is. So that's what really makes it work, and that's the difference, right?
No, because it's in their interest. I mean, you want the best trained people. You want people who are going to be loyal and dedicated. You want people who are going to do the job efficiently and productively so that you can make money. It sounds like, you know, that ultimate, they say win-win a lot. It does sound like a win-win proposition.
In almost every graduation between, we probably crest 60,000 apprentices alone each year. And every graduation, Rick, when that graduate comes up to the stage, who is now going on to be a journey worker in Lyuna, standing there with them is the employer they're going to work for, the local union leader that they're joining, and of course their family. And the contractors love it because they've worked with this apprentice over their 2 or 3 years apprenticeship program for us. And they couldn't love it more, just like you said. I mean, they're invested in it.
Yeah. Now, I've talked to people who, you know, thousands of people throughout the years who have gone through various apprenticeship programs, whether it's the IBEWs or the Bricklayers or Lyunas, and they all say the same thing. I learned valuable skills. It gave me the opportunity to get a really good paying job with incredible health care and retirement security and safe work, all this stuff. But more importantly, it gave me the pride of being part of something and building something. Because I've got a lot of building trades friends who, when I drive through their city with them, they do kind of bore me with I built that, I did that, I didn't do any of that.
Yeah, that's I'm three generations in Lyuna from my family, and we all bore our relatives and friends with the drive-by story.
And you should. You're proud of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about that sort of that partnership. And so whether it's the building trades MC3 program, which is their, pre-apprenticeship and high school program, we have a program called Learn. And so families and many of the kids who are really not sure about what they're going to do after high school, they come into our trade programs in the high schools. And what you see is a kid who's 13 or 14 mature up to that 18-year-old graduate who has met the employers, who have met the union leaders, who have gone through hands-on training. And by the way, so you'll know, to be clear, our high school program does not want 14 and 15 and 16-year-old kids out on job sites. But instead, what we do is community work. We actually, one of our schools in Texas was building beds for a homeless shelter there in Texas, right? And so those kids, you know, wearing Liuna orange, proudly building those things and having them go into that homeless shelter was like, you know, and they know what's at the end of the tunnel. We last week I was at one of our schools in Long Island, and I had a 17-year-old kid talking to me about pensions and annuity and wages, which blew my mind, right? I know I didn't.
No, that's fabulous. And this is what I keep talking about. It's about the education process, not just, you know, swinging the hammer or doing the work, but the entire education process that comes through it. So walk me through. I mean, obviously an apprenticeship week is about, you know, promoting it to the general public, getting people who aren't me to know that they exist. You know, how do people get involved? Like if an 18-year-old kid, let's say my kid, wanted to get into one of these apprenticeship programs, you know, how do you walk through that? You know, when I got to be honest, when I was a young kid, when I was 18, you had to know someone. You know, the trades were a very close knit community that, you know, they knew what they had and they kept it close to the vest. I know that has changed now. How do people navigate this system?
Well, and it's something I've heard you say on other shows, and the key to it now is, again, for Liuna, we have basically a training center in every state or cover multiple states, right? So we're a presence in the community. So now we have parents, and here's the kicker. You're dead on, because when we're talking to the kids, I can see the mom or the dad going, what? How much do you make? What's this like? So they had no idea. So we have apprenticeship directors and coordinators. We're one of the few unions that have a third-party accreditation attached to our apprenticeship directors and coordinators, and we do that for a purpose, so that they understand the value of community partnerships going out. Many of the schools are in the inner cities where the families are. And so it is done through career days. It's going to the schools. It's going to the community centers. It's going to the prisons. I have a great story just real quick. Last year, when apprenticeship is such a wonderful thing, but there is that dark side that pops up every now and then. And some people see apprenticeship as a way to keep wages low for a long period of time. So, of course, the unions were arguing for a living wage. And believe it or not, that was a hard concept for some of the people on this National Apprenticeship Board. So we flew an apprentice from Northern California into Chicago, where the meeting was being taken place. He was incarcerated, pretty heavy stuff, probably could not have been employed in another arena. And as much as we were throwing facts and figures out to talk about the need for an apprenticeship to end in a living wage job, he gets up and he says, you know, says who he is, talked about his life in prison, and now talks about how much money he's making, and he bought a house and he has a car and all the things that he never dreamed would happen. And he said a living wage, the minimum wage, is a poverty wage. And without the apprenticeship program and without now his journey worker wage, he could have never turned his life around. And now he's a foreman, by the way, working for a large company in Northern California.
Yeah, I mean, it's that, you know, look, you don't give somebody the opportunity to put food on their table and keep a roof over their head. They're going to figure out how to do it legally or illegally. So giving people that pathway is phenomenal. And look, I've heard that story repeated time and time and time again over the years, which is why I think what you do is so important. But you said something there that grabbed my attention, that some people use the apprenticeship program as a way to keep wages down. Yours is a registered apprenticeship program, a high quality registered apprenticeship program. I have some people saying to me, hey, you know, Rick, you know, you got these ABC contractors over here. They've got an apprenticeship program. What's the difference? So let me throw it to you. What's the difference between Liuna and your contractors, the union apprenticeship program, and these ABC contractors apprenticeship program?
Well, one is you have to look beyond the numbers, right? So I'll simply say, if you go on a website in Pennsylvania, to an ABC program and look at the wage of what a laborer, and I'll stick with my trade, is getting. It's about $20 less than what our apprentices are making. And the training
So just so I get this square, you have two apprentices, one in the ABC contractor world, non-union sector over there, and the one in the union sector, your apprenticeship program, there's a $20 wage difference?
Oh, yeah. And they publish that. This is what you can get when you graduate your apprenticeship program. And our apprentices are going, well, wait, did you say, yeah, no. I said, don't worry about that. That's not you. This is a union program with union contractors and LIUNA here to represent you. It's absolutely, you know, when I tell you about 60,000 apprentices every year going through our program, and you look on the one site in Pennsylvania and they're just over 1,000 since the start of their program, which I think is 30 years old. It's incredible. Yeah. It really is. The difference is mind-numbing.
One of the things that I've always been told, and maybe you have a bit of information than I do, the non-union contractors who have something of an apprenticeship program, and mm-hmm. yours, you have a graduation rate and a completion rate that just blows them out of the water. I mean, I thought it was something along the lines of you guys graduate like, you know, somewhere like 90% of the people who start the program, and there's like 10%. And what I've been told. I don't know that that's accurate, but is that somewhere in the world?
Yeah, and it is, and it's because of, again, and I'll speak for LIUNA. Imagine, Rick, these training centers do two things. When apprentices come through the training, they are obviously doing classroom training, but the training is activity-based. It's they're not being lectured at. They're involved because, again, things I've heard you say, I want to kind of emphasize is that they're not just being taught to do a job. They're learning a career, and most of the trades have such a wide variety of things for them to do. And then when they leave the classroom, they're going into job simulated hands-on training program. And they're doing that in many times before they even go out to the job. So when our apprentices hit that job site, they've had safety training. They have basic knowledge of tools and equipment. And we want them to be critical thinkers on the job.
Yeah. No. Look, the better trade, the long-term cheaper. They may make higher wages, but being more productive, actually better for the contractor. And for all of this apprenticeship program, all of this training, all of this wonder stuff, what's it cost?
Nothing. In LIUNA, nothing. So if your son was to join one of our three apprenticeship programs in Pennsylvania, he comes into the program, it costs him nothing. Except his boots. Yeah. He'd have to buy his work boots.
And I'd buy them for him. Absolutely. If it's going to get him out of the house, make it a wage more than I've made, then, you know, got good on him. Last question I've got for you, because I know a lot of people like to talk about themselves, their pride and their path through this. You know, tell me about your path through this.
Yeah, I can. I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest of three paths. My father, who actually was there when our local union was chartered in Hartford, Connecticut, 1959. He worked until he was 82 years old. And I don't mean pushing a broom. He was actually doing a demolition job up until that time. And I will say some literacy issues, but if you do come to Connecticut and drive through Hartford, you will see the skyline. And he built about 80% of that skyline. For me, when I entered in, I already had skills, and this happens. This is a great thing that we do is we also assess skills of anybody coming into the program. For instance, when we partner with veterans groups, we did actually a crosswalk between the U.S. Army and our apprenticeship program to see what skills cross over to give them. They don't come in at 60% or 70%. They may come in at a higher rate. So I was able to do that, worked my way up into the field, and was tapped by the Liuna region to take over their, you know, be part of their training program. My two sons, one in New York City building bridges and highways. The other one went to school, took construction management, worked as a laborer, and now has been working for his contractor for the last 7 years, 8 years now.
So the LeConchin name is all over the Northeast is what you're telling me.
And we are. It's been a passion for us. It's been my way of life.
Good on you, John. I appreciate you taking some time sharing some thoughts here. I hope folks will check out the website, liuna.org. We'll get links out on social media. John LeConch, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. We appreciate it very much.
Want to hear your thoughts. You know, is this a path for your kids? Look, we've been told for far too long, everyone's got to go to college, get a degree, and we're saddling them with a lifetime of debt. Here's an option. Great skills, portable lifetime skills. And as John pointed out, you're not digging deep into your pocket to pay for it. Sounds like an option. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy tonight, lingering flurries, lows cold, 5 to 10. For tomorrow, a gradual clearing with a brisk breeze, highs in the upper teens. Sun returns for the rest of the weekend, highs near 20. Temps slowly warm up into the 20s for highs as we look into early next week. Currently, we're at 15.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Monday, Chinese had Xi Jinping, while on his South American tour, met with President Joe Biden for the final time. And an interesting laid out what he calls the four important guardrails and safety nets for China and U.S. relations, saying that they must not be challenged. And he laid it out. He said, you know, the Taiwan question, anything having to do with democracy and human rights, anything having to do with China's path and their system and, you know, their development rights. That is four glaring red lines for him. And look, this was clearly a message for Donald Trump. But what does this mean for us as a country, especially as Trump and company are now calling for broad tariffs and what could be considered the opening salvo of a trade war? Here to share some thoughts on all of that, I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, it's great to be with you.
So what do you make of Xi Jinping doing this South American tour? I mean, they're laying around a lot of cash around. They're, I would argue, you know, filling the voids that we've left in a lot of places, especially places like South America. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's I'm going to paraphrase someone by saying, you know, it's foreign policy with Chinese characteristics, right? It had a little bit of all the tricks up their sleeve, you know, put a port in Peru, you know, spend billions of dollars to upgrade that infrastructure, do the same with some other South American countries. And then kind of that muscular proclamation that you pointed out, Rick, about like, we're happy to be friends as long as you never disagree with us, basically, right? And so
give us what we want and never question us, and we'll be great friends.
Right? So it's, and I guess the issue is the, you know, the United States position on Taiwan is that the people on Taiwan should get to determine who they want as their leader. And right now they don't want anyone from the mainland. They don't want to be part of that because it's not a system that provides an opportunity to change your government at all. And so, you know, and then the other aspect is that China really doesn't like when the United States or nations look under the hood at what's happening in China and the oppression of minority groups, of faith traditions, obviously of dissidents. There's, you know, literally no ability to change the government there. And they don't like that. And then they also feel like that when nations push back against what I think, in my view, is very aggressive Chinese economic behavior, like the massive subsidization of the industry. No one buys the stuff in China. They sell it all overseas, and it wipes out broad swaths of manufacturing, not only in the United States, but in Western Europe and other places too. And then the, somehow when we push back on that, that's called interfering with Chinese development, right? Even though it's really had dire consequences for a lot of factory workers, a lot of industries in the United States, and that's bled over into devastating a lot of communities and eroding our capabilities to make really basic things. Yeah, so it's a it's interesting because Biden has known Xi for decades now, and they used to interact when Biden was the vice president under under Obama, and so it's got to be kind of like a bit of a bitter ending for Biden because he really he understood, to his great credit, I will say, he understood Xi and he understood what he was about, and the United States policy towards China was way more muscular under Biden than it was under Trump or that it was under Obama. Right. And I know I'm not going to persuade some people that that was the case, but if you factually look at the record and the sanctions that were put into place and the tariffs, the additional tariffs that were put into place, and a lot of these other policies and enlisting our allies to do the same, I think it was a deep understanding. And so hopefully we don't take a step back from that when we're back to another Trump administration here.
No, and I would argue, and I'm gonna follow up on what you've said, and because I think I agree with you, but did it in a way that wasn't bloviating, wasn't overly public, wasn't putting Xi on the spot, wasn't trying to make them look bad, just doing the job. And not looking for people to give him credit or accolades or you see how tough he is. Because I look at someone like Trump and I go, you know, the reality is I see him as kind of a paper bully. You know, he made a lot of threats. He made a lot of promises. Didn't really hold up on the China thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, there's going to be a couple of tests. And I mean, one of them was the lure of the deal. That got Trump to stop the tariff, the tariff escalation, and China eagerly signed a deal, and Trump eagerly signed it, and China said we're going to buy this stuff, half the stuff they're going to buy anyway, which was American energy, right? Because you can't get any cheaper, right. so there was that, and then the other part they never bought any of it, and so but Trump got to declare victory. And he was happy to say he had a deal like that. And then, you know, Trump was against TikTok.
Before he was for it.
Before he was for it. And we're going to see what happens now, because that's going to come to a head very soon, because the deadline for the divestment of TikTok ownership from Chinese hands has to occur very soon. So we'll see what happens there too.
Yeah. Now I looked at Paul Krugman, the columnist over at the New York Times, had a piece that there was a line in there that caught my attention, and it basically is saying that, you know, we learned in the 2000s, you know, the China shock. We learned what happens. We learned that whatever virtue, this is what he wrote, whatever the real virtues of free trade, a huge import surge does unacceptable damage to workers and communities in its path. He points out that furthermore, China is an autocracy that doesn't share democratic values, allowing it to dominate strategic critical industries, and it's an unacceptable risk. And I agree with all of that. And the question I have is, have we really learned the lesson? And then what is that going to mean as the Trump administration comes in and what they're going to want or have to do?
Yeah, well, that's a great question because, you get this fatigue on China and tariffs. And the fact that Trump has lifted up tariffs means that, you know, honestly, most Democrats are going to be like, I don't want to do this, right? I don't want to do tariffs because it's a Trump. It's a Trump policy now, even though it had been, interestingly, a Biden policy.
Right? No, look, I had been calling for tariffs long before Donald Trump came on the scene.
Oh, I know you have. I have too. But I think here's the interesting thing, and this reminds me of, like, the United States has been very clearly laying out this case that China has massive overcapacity, that a China shock 2.0. Is in the works and that we have to guard against it. And they've had Secretary Janet Yellen come out and say this, and they've had Secretary of State Tony Blinken say the same thing. And these guys are not trade hawks, right? They are not trade hawks at all. They're the opposite. So for them to come out and signal this and to also indicate to our allies that they have to take this very seriously reminds me, you know, from a trade sense, what we were doing with Ukraine before the Russian invasion and saying, look, we know this is coming. We have the intelligence. You need to prepare for it. And there was a lot of denial, at the time. And so my hope is that people will listen to this warning and know that it is not hyperbole, that it is based on history. It's based on data. It's based literally on what we know China wants to do because it lays it out in 5-year plans. It's not a secret. They're like, we want to dominate the world in this stuff. Right.
Because that's our job. Look, you know, just recently here on the program, I talked to another economist who was saying, look, you know, and I agree with him that what China is doing now, we had done in the 50s and 60s. We went around the world. We spread a lot of industry around. We spread some money around. We rebuilt communities. I would argue for different reasons and with different kind of priorities. Spreading democracy and freedom and all that thing seems like altruistic ideals. But I think China just wants complete world domination. And here we are in this fight between, you know, democracy and freedom and communism with a tinge of capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah. And Rick, the big difference here is the way China is doing this is massively destructive to other industrial democracies. The way the United States did it was to invest heavily in the countries we just conquered, right? You know, or because of World War II, like Japan and Germany helped to build those industries back up. We gave away market access, and yes, there was a quid pro quo, I will say. It was like basically support us in the Cold War, right, against the Soviet Union. So there was that. But none of our policies really caused industries to flee other countries and come to the United States. You know, we made the pie bigger all right over the world. And yeah, we wanted a big share of it. That is true. But we were in a position both to be economically dominant, but also to give things away. In fact, you know, I think you can argue we gave too much away.
Oh, we gave way too much away. In fact, you know, what is it? Yeah. Just recently was the 31st anniversary of NAFTA. And look, NAFTA was horribly destructive. The whole neoliberal trade agenda was horribly destructive, as people were at the time, me as well, predicting this is the downfall of the working class of America. And you wonder why working people are angry. You know, for the last 31 years, they've been getting screwed over. And this is where I thought Biden did the right thing. I thought Biden was moving us away from this. But here we are, this still with the pain and the suffering and the struggle of NAFTA.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we're still fighting these fights, and we're fighting them from an economic perspective. And you see that on the factory floor and at the bargaining table. But it's a political fight, too. And you see it at the ballot box. And this is the part that I think is devastating, is that it was because of Bill Clinton And some Democrats that like this pro-corporate neoliberal model that led us down this path. Whereas, and I'm just going to say this, most of the party, most of like the House of Representatives were against this. People like Sherrod Brown, unfortunately, who lost his election, or David Bonnier, who I worked for at that time. And they fought like hell against all of this stuff. And they were against this way before Trump ever was, by the way. And to Biden's great credit, you know, he kind of came around to that point of view and adopted that. But it's almost like what? Too much, too little, too late. I guess I think there's a song like that. But I think that was part of the problem. And you know, I think that it was like really embedded into the institutional memories of all of these communities and all of these working families. And that's not something you can turn around in a year or honestly in 4 years.
No,
I think
it's
a longer project.
Absolutely. Yeah. But this is where I think it's unfair to Democrats because there were more Democrats that voted against it. There were more Republicans that voted for it.
That's right.
But Bill Clinton signed it. You could go, but you know, Rick, he did put some of the environmental and the labor standards, you know, were toothless as they were. He did try. But understand that snowball started under Reagan, was fully negotiated under H.W. Bush, but it was Bill Clinton who put his name on the dotted line, which is why Democrats have been the one to own it. And again, Republicans continue to skate off scot-free for the responsibility of things that they did and started.
Yes, absolutely right. They're responsible for the theory. They're responsible for the initial negotiations. They're responsible for many of the trade agreements. And honestly, they're responsible for the majorities that got them passed, too. But somehow Democrats get stuck with the blame because you have Donald Trump talking about it. And you had other guys talking about it before. You obviously had Ross Perot talking about it in the 90s. You had Pat Buchanan talking about this stuff. You had Ralph Nader talking about it. But there's been a lot of folks who have talked about it. Bernie Sanders. But Trump made it stick to the Democrats, which is just, you know, I will say this, you got to push back. Right. And that's the thing is that, you know, there's a lesson here. If they're going to try to punch you in the mouth on this, you got to punch them back in the mouth on the trade stuff with the facts that you just presented and how they want to stand up. And if you left it up to a lot of the Republicans, we'd be negotiating more free trade deals.
So when they go low, you're not going high on this then, right?
I'm going with the legal punch is what I'm going with.
I'm ramming their face in the ground with it. But so the question I have in the last line of question I've got for you, look, if you ever played football, you know that's the response. Someone comes for your knees, face in the dirt. So what does this mean for Trump? Because he has run on this his 4 years in the White House. We had lots of manufacturing weeks. We had lots of infrastructure weeks. We got none of it. He, like any good salesman, he's got the rap. He just doesn't have the product to deliver. What should he do? What can he do? And, you know, if you're advising him, you know, what is it that we're doing to move the country forward that might actually help working people instead of just be rhetoric?
Yeah, well, the stuff that he can and should do, he can do with some executive authority, and that's the strategic application of tariffs. And by this, I don't mean taxes on your groceries when you're going to the grocery store, right? Because that's I don't think that's going to help us a lot. But it does mean the strategic application of tariffs because there's a lot more that we can and should do. Here's my concern. Even if they're on task on that, you know, there's not a lot that the Republicans in the Congress are going to be willing to do, and certainly nothing for working people, right? So we're not going to get a big infrastructure bill. We're not going to get industrial policy investments in other industries outside of semiconductors. In fact, they may get rolled back in some areas. And what we might get are a bunch of no strings attached tax cuts for corporations. And that's not going to bring jobs back to the United States. And so I am concerned about the direction that this could go. But if he gets the right people and he has the right trade policy, that is a step forward. If it's done strategically the right way, that is part of the solution But again, I think all of these trading countries now know he's lured by a deal, Rick. Yeah. He's lured by a deal. So all they got to do is dangle something in front of him, and it's like a shiny object. He's going to be like, okay, I think this is great. And that's not going to be acceptable.
Yeah, no, he just wants the pat on the head. But, you know, look, you know, I think what Biden was doing was right. You know, smart investments in industry and innovation, invest in the country, have a strengthened and muscular Buy American program, and increase apprenticeship programs to get workers the skills that they need to build these industries. If Trump does this, if he does those things, and I got to tell you, my belief that he will is very low. But if he were to do these things, you know, he could potentially be the third, you know, the third three-term president that he wants to be and thinks that he's going to be able to be, because this is what people want.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it's going to be additive to the Biden efforts, right? I mean, I'm not holding my breath, right?
Yeah, I think but everything with Biden's name on it gets chucked day one.
Yeah, because there is something to build on, and he's going to be the beneficiary no matter what, because all of the factories that were started under Biden, the semiconductor factories, they're going to get finished over the next 2 or 3 years, and you bet your bottom dollar he's going to show up, right, and claim credit for all of that stuff.
And you know, that's the thing that irks me. When they vote against this stuff, they try and destroy this stuff, and then when it's done and it's reaping benefits, look how wonderful we did. You did nothing.
That's right.
But we will see. Scott, as always, I appreciate the insight. Good stuff.
Rick, thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Our good friend Scott Paul. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you think we're going to get an industrial policy out of Trump, or is it going to be more con man sales tricks? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was the day that 320,000 United Auto Workers went out on strike against General Motors. The strike was part of a wave of work actions that washed over the country after World War II. Workers were growing more and more frustrated that company profits were soaring while workers' wages remained stagnant. During the war, most unions had abided by no strike pledges. But once the war was over, workers wanted their fair share of the growing American economy. In just 1 year, 5 million workers participated in more than 4,500 strikes. The GM strikers demanded a 30% pay increase. Walter Reuther, president of the UAW, also insisted that the company could meet this demand without raising the prices of their vehicles. He asked the company to open their books so workers and the public could see the full details of the company's profits. GM refused. They characterized Reuther as a socialist for even making such an outrageous request. During negotiations, Harry Cohen, the GM assistant director of personnel, told President Reuther, quote, "Why don't you get down to your size and get down to the type of job you're supposed to be doing as a trade union leader and talk about money you would like to have for your people and let the labor statesmanship go to hell for a while." The GM strike lasted 113 days. The workers won a 17.5% pay increase and improvements to vacation and overtime. But they did not get to look at GM's books or gain any say on how GM vehicles were priced.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, look, we've talked about NAFTA for, well, pretty much all the nearly 20 years we've been doing this show. And understand that the reality, the facts, are that NAFTA was birthed under the Reagan era. They wanted a North American trade bloc. They wanted to expand. Ultimately, they understood what they were doing. This was all about breaking the unions. They knew what they were doing back during the Reagan era. They knew what they wanted. It was fully negotiated during the H.W. Bush years. They were all on board. And there were some. And you know, look, I remember the argument like it happened yesterday because I was immediately against it. What? We're going to have to compete, you know, toe-to-toe with a desperate economy? With people who are making a less than a dollar an hour? And understand, back then, you know, people were only, you know, making, you know, the low end of the economy. I think I was only making like, I was making about $15 an hour back then, which was a good living back then, but not, you know, not a buck an hour. You can't compete with that. And I remember being, you know, dead set against it and saying, this is a bad idea. We should stop it because we're going to see, as Ross Perot, so eloquently said, you know, say, we're going to have a giant second sound. And he was right. You know, that crazy big-eared guy was absolutely spot on, as out there as he was on a lot of other issues. On that, he was right. As a business person, just understood the need of the CEO class to exploit cheap labor. And it did. We hemorrhaged jobs out of this country. And I don't say lost, because we didn't lose them. We know where they are. The corporate class decided, hey, we can exploit cheaper labor. We can exploit lax environmental regulations. We can do all of the things that we've always dreamed about doing because that we can't do here because those workers want to be safe and they want to be paid and they want health insurance and they want weekends and they want their kids to go to school. How dare they? And look, they're tearing all of that down. This is major mission accomplished. When you stop and you think about in the big picture, corporate America is getting their wet dream list. You go back to then and, you know, working people got it. They were against it. And the Democrats got it, which is why more Democratic members of Congress voted against it than voted for it. There were more Republicans that voted for it than voted against it. This was one of those bipartisan things. It was a bipartisan bad idea. And the election of 1992, the Republican George H.W. Bush, who had fully negotiated it, and Bill Clinton, who eventually signed it, were on the same page. This was one of those things. There was consensus in the corporate class. And they told us this was going to be great. We were all going to get corner offices. We were all going to wear white shirts. And it was, we wouldn't have to do those dirty jobs anymore. We wouldn't have to do that manufacturing and have all the illnesses and the injuries. It was going to be great. And some people bought it. Working people understood it was going to be the end of their communities. It was going to be the end of their livelihoods, which is what Trump was able to exploit. I've said this a million times, and I'll say it a million more times. My family, otherwise known as the Basket of Deplorables, never voted. Racist, homophobic, all that, misogynistic, all that stuff. Absolutely. That's the era in which they grew up in and lived in. But they didn't vote for him for those things, because he is obviously all of those things. They voted for him because he sold them on the idea that he heard them. He heard their struggles. He felt their pain, to steal a Bill Clinton frame. And he was going to do something. He was going to bring back those jobs. That economic might and that economic glory was coming back. And then he did a bait and switch. He did the Lucy. He pulled the ball away because he didn't have a plan. Like a good con man salesman, they know what the customer wants to hear. And the customer wanted to hear, it's going to be okay. We're going back to the good old days. Just vote for me. And they've heard it again. But understand, he still doesn't have a plan. Concepts of a plan, but not a plan. And I argue that Biden had us on the right path, and Harris would have continued that path. The idea of using tariffs in a strategic way, the idea of investing in manufacturing and innovation, the idea of expanding apprenticeship programs, and the idea of, you know, maybe if we need to build roads and bridges, maybe we make the stuff we need right here at home, so the investments we're making not only have the shot in the arm from the building, but the shot in the arm for building the products that we need. Will Trump do any of that stuff? I don't know. If he does, he will do very well as president. But I don't think he will. Because, again, I don't think he can. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News.